Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Bruce Bilson makes a welcome appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's well known to you for his role in government, but I'll introduce him briefly. Educated at RMIT in Melbourne, he worked in business, he's worked in local government, but the member for Deakin since 1996 with an office in Frankston. He held parliamentary secretary positions in the Howard government. He held senior positions in opposition. But of course, most importantly, Mr. Bilson was made Minister for Small Business in the Cabinet since the Abbott government's election in September 2013. He's had a big role in the current budget, and the Minister's going to talk to us tonight on small business after the budget. Mr. Bilson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared, to the directors of the Sydney Institute. Well, isn't it great? Isn't this a fantastic venue? And we want to thank Maddox for that as well. And thank you to all of you for being here this evening. The good news I have to report is small business is the new black. Everybody's talking about small business. And for me, that is a great achievement in its own right. Some of you would know I've been either the Cabinet Minister for Small Business or the Shadow Minister now for some 6 years. And this community percolates through my veins as I believe so greatly in what they do. And for the community that I represent, the electorate of Dunkley, the Riviera of Melbourne, small business and family enterprises, well, they are the economy for the community that I represent. And I'm sensing we're at a great time in our nation's history, the start of a great era where enterprising men and women know they're valued, they are supported with their entrepreneurship, and they have a government keen to encourage them to take an idea or an ambition and translate that into economic activity. And I think that's where we need to be. That was the story of the budget last week. I have been accused of being the budget bandit. I'm happy to wear that tag, although I think Care Bear became popular today in The Australian, and I'm not quite sure what that was about. But the budget was a task of reassigning priorities, about encapsulating the convictions and the key objectives of the Abbott government. And what that involved was an identification of savings to be able to fund the largest small business package in our nation's history. $5.5 billion through the Growing Jobs and Small Business Package has been developed over a number of years. We've been making progress, all the while realising whatever it is we want to do, we need to be able to fund it. I assure you there's a whole bunch of other ideas and initiatives as well, and that this package represents an instalment in what it is we seek to achieve. My work will be done when our nation is the best place to start and grow a small business, and we're not there yet. But we are making gains, and enterprising people both here in our economy and beyond are taking notice of what we're doing. It's really important, I think, to grasp the significance of the small business and family enterprise community. They play a crucial role in the vitality of our economy, in the vibrancy of our communities. They are not handcuffed to a mining pit. They are not attached to a tower of financial services workers. They are in every corner of our vast continent, taking a risk, often mortgaging their houses, to provide opportunities for themselves and others. And it's that kind of spirit, it's that kind of endeavour, it's that ambition and that entrepreneurship that we wanted to not only recognise and celebrate through the budget, but put meaningful support around what I call the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Is it supportive? Is it encouraging? Does it nurture ideas and ambition and the growth and jobs that flow from the enterprise of our men and women? And that's something that is a key priority for me and our government. Now, it's important for a range of reasons, not only because small business is personal. I've had one, and I admire small businessmen and women who continue to compete because our business failed. And the decision to close it was one of the toughest professional decisions of our life. Didn't matter that I had a master's in business leadership and all those sorts of things. The spunkiest, most neatest, nearest correct business plan you've ever seen. Married well, my wife, a young retailer of the year candidate. All the acumen and talent that we needed. Great suppliers, a great team, the right location, mighty expensive rent. I should acknowledge the shopping centre council while I'm on my feet. It wasn't one of your members' properties. It was just a suburban premise in Mornington, 60 kilometres out of downtown Melbourne, where the lease rate was the same as Southbank. Delicious real estate, highly sought after retail precinct. We had the best art and fine craft, Colin Heaney's blown glass, spectacular stuff. But a discretionary spend it was as well. No one wakes up in the morning thinking, what do I spend my last $600 on? Rarely is it a piece of blown glass. But we persevered. The pillow talk of cash flow, the idea of what else can we do, the all-encompassing nature of that kind of family enterprise. I've said facetiously for my wife and I, it was the greatest contraceptive ever invented. All-encompassing is the life of a small business person. Thinking about what else is it we can do to improve the performance of our enterprise. Well, we didn't make it. And that's why I have great admiration and salute those that continue to thrive and succeed and want to dedicate my efforts to supporting their entrepreneurship. So it's personal. And that should make it a priority in a nation that wants to support endeavour and enterprise, because that's what's helped grow our economy and that is the strategy for the future. But it's also a very significant part of our economy. 96% of all of the enterprises operating in our economy are small businesses. They provide just over 4 out of 10, every 10 private sector job. They're generating $330 billion of economic activity. They are for many, and it was interesting to hear after the budget night, alongside the accolades from the small business community and their representatives, that even the social security and welfare community were saying, good on you, government. Because for people that have been out of work for a while or are seeking to return to work, it is often a small business or family enterprise that has the courage to give someone that start. So it made a lot of sense at that level. But another key attribute of it is what's going on in our nation and what's going on amongst us as a people. We've seen through the intergenerational report the ageing of our population, how we will need to be more productive, more able to generate wealth and income if we are to sustain the improvements in living standards that have been the hallmark of our country for generations. If we don't act, if we leave those policy settings where they were when we inherited them from the previous government, we would fail that great promise. We would be the first generation to gift to the next a lesser standard of living than the one we've enjoyed. That's not why I got into public life. And that's not what we're about as a nation. And that's why energising enterprise has to be at the heart of sound and considered and sure-footed policy making coming out of our nation's capital. Because you look at the ageing population and what that means for the workforce. But think also about the demography of our small business community. We all know, and let's be kind, mature-age small business owners anticipating the sale of their enterprise will fund their retirement, only to find the appetite to buy an established business has diminished as disruptors in our economy change the whole concept of what the value proposition is. The appetite to spend on goodwill diminished greatly as well because of the mobility and agility of consumers. And of that next generation of entrepreneurs, do they have the resources to purchase? In our case, we mortgaged our house. We had a house and some equity in it. But for many, thinking about a career in entrepreneurship and being their own boss and creating their own opportunities, that asset nest egg isn't there. So we need to think about that also. Our strengths in our economy. So bright has mining shone that I fear it has blurred the vision of what else is going on in the economy and what else we need to do to provide a deep, diverse and resilient economic future for our country. Those highs have been very high, but we've seen that that's currently a fairly flat area of our economy. The terms of trade are nothing as spectacular as they were in the past. And of course, when commodity prices are so high, you get a supplier response and everyone else wants a piece of the action. And in part, that explains some of the movement in price. So we need to take stock of what does that mean for us? And that means we need to be better able to improve productivity, economic growth, to support innovation, and through that create the jobs and the incomes and the quality of life of the future. For me, the pathway is all about energising enterprise. And this is a conversation that we've heard not only as I've advocated and others in our nation's capital, but capitals around the world. Look at the G20, all talking about accelerating the rate of growth in developed economies. Look past those statements of reform, and what do you see? An ambition to get behind the innovative, adaptive, agile and creativity of small business and family enterprise. So this is about shaping our destiny, building from the strength of our people and the appetite for entrepreneurship and the support for private endeavour that has to be at the heart of our economic future. We need to look into the hearts of those risk takers and ask them, what is it that we need to do to encourage you to take an idea and turn it into action? We need to look to those entrepreneurs and say, what kind of environment will bring out the best in you so that through you and your endeavours, opportunities will flow to others? We need to get back the small business mojo that suffered so greatly under the previous government, where 519,000 jobs were lost in small business over those 6 years, where at the end of that six-year period, fewer small businesses were employing people than was the case when the Howard government left office, where the share of the private sector workforce went from 52% of every private sector job to 43% being hosted by a small business. That atrophy has to stop and we have to turn it around, and that's what the budget was all about. We said as a government, get that ecosystem right and small business and enterprising people will create the jobs and economic opportunities of the future. And that will involve dealing with and creating new possibilities that recognise that mining is not going to be there and deliver all that we need into the future. It'll still be important and it will still be significant. But even in the mining story, let's not lose sight of the mining services and technology, the know-how that it has enabled those extraordinary projects and the systems that have created wealth to be delivered in our country. There's an appetite for that as an export service that recognises that mining is not just about what we dig out of the ground, it's about how we do it and the way we turn that into wealth and opportunity. And we think about what else is happening in that construction phase in the mining industry. A couple of years ago to where we will be in a couple of years' time, there's a $40 billion differential in mining infrastructure investment. Now, I think the mining tax has spooked a lot of investment from our country to find other places to land. And that in part accounts for that investment coming off a cliff. But it also has impacts far beyond those mining sites. Did you know those pilot boats that have to ply whatever the sea state is in the Indian Ocean to get out to those gas platforms off the northwest shelf there are made in my electorate in Dunkley? You couldn't be further away. But there at Hart Marine is a small business that needs to be world class in what it produces, cost competitively internationally, and also make sure that they are at the leading edge of innovation. What's their offer? World best technology. Pilot boats that self-right. No one dies. The work can continue. That's a value proposition that they can take out and win work from the rest of the world. And that's what we need to think about in terms of our future. It's not just about the newsagents or the shop corner, but it's about those independent contractors offering legal and professional advice, the IT consultants that are building up some of the technology capabilities that are needed for the future, the mums starting a business, a renaissance in mumpreneurs. The fact that more women today are starting a small business than blokes. And isn't that great? And that's a story of people aligning their economic ambition with what they aim for as a family and as a community. And we should celebrate that and commit ourselves to supporting that kind of entrepreneurship. The productivity piece needs the small business community. The agility, the adaptability, the capacity to innovate and introduce new ideas and new concepts of value. New service possibilities, new ways to delight customers, to see that then spread its way and disrupt its way through the broader economy. This is why I'm evangelical about what I do. It is so important to my community and our nation and our future prospects to be left to a discussion that only happens now and then. Let the new black of talking about small business continue to be in fashion every season. The people in small business deserve that, and I'm up for that conversation. That's why we've said, let's pick up what we've got, what we inherited from the previous government. Let's understand the trends and trajectories in our people and in our economy and what other economies are doing as well. Let's play to our strengths. Let's nurture that entrepreneurship and let's support the value creation, jobs and growth that enterprising people will create. And it's private endeavour. It's private endeavour. What characterises that $5.5 billion from other measures that may seek to achieve similar outcomes is we're not telling people that government knows best about how to spend your tax dollars. We're saying to enterprising people who are spending their own money, you can have a chunk of it back sooner. We will accelerate the depreciation of that asset, that new piece of plant, that extra coffee machine that means when people walk past your shop to catch the commuter train in the morning, you don't lose half those customers because you're not tooled up to equip and able to meet that need. That if you want to cater for places like Maddox for a corporate function, why not buy that small van? Why not get that oven? Why not buy that technology that lets a dry cleaner send an SMS out automatically when an item of clothing has been processed? These are what the ideas are, and this is why there's been such a universal acclaim for this package. $20,000 instant asset write-off is a substantial commitment to innovation and retooling and equipping these enterprises to delight customers and grow their business into the future. It started on budget night. You needed a turnover of under $2 million, a business-related purchase, and you could deduct it in the year of purchase, not extend that depreciation over a number of years. We also wanted to encourage behaviour through reward and incentive, not just the asset write-off, but the company tax cut, 1.5%. Some say you should have gone further. I'd like to, believe me. I have ambitions to, but we need to fund it. But what we are doing will take the small business company tax rate down to the lowest it's been since 1967, when Sadie the cleaning lady was number one, when Sergeant Peppers had just been released, and when I was a newborn. But we know that 2/3 of small businesses aren't structured as companies. And that was the error that the opposition leader made in his speech, where he outlined an ambition without a plan to get anywhere with it. He ignored that 2/3 of small enterprises are independent contractors. They're self-employed. They're sole traders. They work through partnerships and trusts. And that's why we've come up with an agile measure that says calculate your tax liability on your income as you normally would, and we'll give you a 5% discount. That's exactly proportionate to the company tax cut. That is recognising the diversity of small business across our economy and giving them some encouragement. We've been able to achieve that because I'm in Cabinet. I'm able to advocate the interests of the small business community every day and able to contest ideas that are unhelpful to that ambition or to advocate further action where more needs to be done. The small business portfolio is now no longer tacked onto the side of industry. Industry does some good work. They do their best work with industry sectors, with homogenous challenges and a single plan that will meet everybody's needs in that sector. That's not the life of small business. The diversity, the agility, the curiosity, the marching to their own beat, which is what I love about small businessmen and women, needs a broader economy-wide approach. Those policy settings are formulated and analysed by Treasury. Small business is now a cabinet position in the Treasury portfolio. And when the economic policy powerhouse of the Commonwealth is doing its work, it has no choice but to confront and address, to embrace and consider the needs of small business. And they do that as a matter of course, otherwise I get cranky. And despite being a care bear in The Australian today, I am pretty driven by conviction of the importance of this work. They need to get past the macroeconomic analysis to understand the behavioural economics in the small business community. What turns that sparkle in the eye into a business idea? What can we do to stoke the fire in the belly of having a go and of creating wealth and opportunity for yourself and others? Our strategy is largely threefold, three key elements. First, get the roadblocks out of the road. Get the choke points, get the headwinds, get the unnecessary obstacles out of the road. Second, make sure government gets its act together. Its act together. Many small businesses compete internationally. They need to be world class. Surely that should be the benchmark for our policy formulation. To be a supporter and an ally, not lead in the saddlebag for that entrepreneurial contest. And thirdly, get those incentives, the rewards and the opportunities for private endeavour right. And that's the way we've gone about it. Red tape reduction we could talk at length about. But the World Economic Forum said at the last election we were 128th in the world. Only 127 other economies less gummed up than ours. Does that help us compete? I think not. Does that displace effort? The opportunity cost is enormous. We need to tackle that. When the Howard government left office, we were 68th in the world. That was mid-table, that was mediocre. But I'll let you in on a bit of a secret. When politicians are being called to act and they've run out of money, you know what the only other tool is in the toolkit in most cases? It's to regulate. You look like you're doing something. You might convince yourself it's only a little bit of an extra straw on the camel's back that would rather not be a camel but be a gazelle. And that's why after 21,000 new and amended regulations, our ranking is appalling. And unlike the sporting field in this country, you don't get any early draft picks to lift your game. You've got to work your way out of it, and we've done that. The billion-dollar commitment's been turned into $2.5 billion already. But going beyond that, it's the conduct of the regulators as well. Are they right-sized in their interventions? Are they problem-solving or are they trying to be combative? Can we get the consultation processes right so that when government's considering a program that it's formulating or a policy it's developing, you know, it's really easy to talk to big business and big industry organisations? You want to see how that works? Have a look at Fair Work. The whole architecture is designed by industry associations and big unions. Yet 96% of the respondents know little about either. Yet they are fitted up with that architecture and have to navigate it even though they don't have 20 people in the compliance department. In our own area of work, what's the point of having an export market development grant program designed to help small business if you can't climb over the requirements to access it? What's the point of having an export finance and insurance corporation designed to help SMEs bring in export income if the requirements to even be taken seriously are well beyond the scope of the average small business? What's the justification for that government-funded institution backing Rio Tinto when its balance sheet's better than the Commonwealth of Australia, while the small business with a service idea that would delight the marketplace in China looks for some help and assistance to get paid and to scale up to meet that chance? Free trade agreements. Hundreds of millions of prospective new customers. But opening the door is not enough. You know, those agreements are a remarkable achievement from Andrew Robb. But let's align our efforts to make sure small and medium enterprises can make use of them. 70% of our economy is the service economy. 1 in 7 of our export dollars is services. Huge gap, huge opportunity. Another example about the government getting its act together to support the entrepreneurship of small business. And finally, the rewards and the opportunities and the competitive environment. 22 years since Hilma did excellent work on competition policy. The market's changed dramatically since then. Our goal of having an economy where efficient businesses, big and small, can thrive and prosper, where the rules of healthy competition are known and encourage investment, that's an ambition that's in all of our interests. The idea that durable consumer interest is what will delight our marketplace prepares us well to win those opportunities in the North Asian markets where doors have been opened by Andrew Robb's work. So you might have picked this up, I'm pretty upbeat. And I am that every day because it's that positivity and optimism that encourages people to act. The budget has been universally welcomed by the small business community. Even some big businesses have realised that if we're going to buy a new piece of technology to improve our business, it's got to come from somewhere. We've seen encouraging signs about the optimism percolating its way through, that it's a confidence-building budget, that it will go some way towards recovering those 519,000 jobs that I touched on earlier, that it recognises the market is changing and small businesses are agile and able to make best use of those opportunities. I'm trying to position the Commonwealth as a collaborator, an ally and an advocate, not an adversary. An institution in our economy that supports entrepreneurship, not stifles or dampens it. We'd offer a range of ways of doing that. A voice in cabinet. Policy formulation that continues to be rolled out. Reforms in the area of the franchising code, where that kind of weird relationship between a franchisor and franchisee starts with music and the equivalent of a commercial marriage proposal, and can turn into rather unpleasant parent-child when a dispute arises. Unfair contract terms protections. The take-it-or-leave-it contracts that a big business can enforce on a small business with no capacity to push back. That allows a universal right to vary terms for one party and not the other. That encourages or facilitates legal action by the big party but seems to contract out the right of the little party to do it. That advertising contract that says unless you advise us you're cancelling it between the 16th and 21st of May, it will be deemed to have rolled over, and if you realise and ring on the 22nd, you'll have to pay out the 2 years to get out of it. That's not the way to build our economy, and no business, whatever size, should seek to advantage its position from unfair contracts. The right to repair. You buy a car, you should be able to take it to any competent mechanic to repair it, not have some kind of exclusive dealing arrangement achieved by an inability to access IP and technical advice and tools. The Food and Grocery Code of Conduct. It's not too much to ask our big supermarkets to actually have a grocery supply agreement available to their suppliers that tells them what they're buying, what the prices will be, and they'll actually pay on time. And there's no right to unilaterally vary it and change the rules and demand promotion payments and all sorts of things, or even reimbursement if some of your stock in the hands of the retailer or wholesaler gets shoplifted and you as a supplier have to pay for it. That is not the way to encourage investment and a healthy supply arrangement. I could run through a range of other policy commitments that we are implementing, but our work hasn't finished. As I said, my goal is to make our economy and our country the best place to start and grow a small business. To go to debutante balls and not hear young men wanting to play for the Melbourne Storm. I admit that's a bit insensitive in Sydney, but there you have it. To hear them talk about wanting to be an entrepreneur. To celebrate and value the achievements of entrepreneurial men and women. To realise that a job is important, but creating one for yourself and others is to be heralded and celebrated. To work out what happens to our science, engineering and technology undergraduates, three quarters of whom aspire to be an entrepreneur when they start their degree, but by the time they're finished, only a third do. To get our intellectual property laws right. To work out why venture capital is sometimes too difficult to do. To get in place a crowdsourced equity funding framework. To energise employee share schemes as a great way of aligning business goals with that of your team. This is the work we are involved with. This is the work that is about our nation's future. This is a renaissance in enterprise that everyone played a part in and has been contributing to. There's more work to be done. I'll be done when we are the poster child of the place to start and grow a business. And I'm grateful for a few minutes of your time. Thank you.
Well, many thanks to the Minister. Before we go to questions and discussions, thanks also to the law firm Maddox, as the Minister said, for the use of this fine facility this evening. I think the Minister left Dunkley this morning at in the very early hours in Melbourne and arrived in Sydney, and it's been a long day and a long night.
Well, I was with Mark Boris things. And people thought we were twins, and I had to disavow them.
So now we come to questions and discussion. This is not a personal question, but why are you in the Cabinet? I mean, what was the reason that Tony Abbott had, I think in opposition days, that there was a need to put small business in the Cabinet, and why couldn't you have done it somewhere else? Because you're pretty, as we've seen tonight, you're pretty energetic. So,
Well, is that a job interview request? Or, well, two reasons. I could facetiously say merit matters most, and 17 years in public life might have contributed something, but in all seriousness, it underlines a conviction and a fundamental belief that, and it was captured by the small business community in the lead up to the last election, small business too big to ignore. Now, I love enterprise wherever you find it. Let a thousand flowers bloom is my view. But for those 4% of businesses that are quite capable, quite well resourced and able to engage lobbyists to walk the halls of Canberra, they really need my help. For those courageous men and women that are just having a go in Frankston or in West Ryde or, you know, or in Penrith where I was yesterday, they do need somebody. And when we're talking about policy proposals, let me give you some examples. Audit Commission recommendation to wind up EFIC. My role? No. That is a bad idea.
So EFIC?
EFIC has been retasked.
EFIC is
the Export Finance and Insurance Corporation. And they go where the banks won't go, because our big banks particularly don't have to go there. You might win a supply contract into Azerbaijan. Now, their bank's expertise in that country is zero. Whereas to achieve the export income, you may need a finance facility or even insurance or even a guarantee that will enable other forms of finance to meet your need. EFIC needed to focus on the SMEs. EFIC had lost its way and offered a facility to Rio. That gave the economic hardheads a chance to say, that's ridiculous, because where it was working, there was no market dysfunction. But there was a market dysfunction in SMEs. And my role, Jared, is to say, hang on a minute, that might make sense what you're proposing for that part of the economy, but for the rest, that would be an act of self-harm. Even the restoration of powers for the Australian Building and Construction Commission. We hear big builders having big fights with big unions. And that's fascinating, and at times there's a curious relationship between the two. No one suffers more than the subcontractors. No one is punished more when there's lawlessness on building sites than the little businesses. That's why I'm in Cabinet. I turn up every day, and I go into the fray every day, because that's what small businessmen and women do, and we need someone at the decision-making table to make that case every day.
Right, so, yes.
You've been in small business, didn't work out the way you wanted to, but you go on to bigger and better things. But what would you say when you go around? What are maybe four or five qualities you find that make successful small business people?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to think we didn't peak early, might be another way of describing our business. Or I think in Treasury speak, the outcomes were suboptimal. So four or five things I see and I try and share is that this is an opportunity for everybody if this is something that they have a passion for. I encourage people to learn from the wisdom around them. There are a few commercial challenges someone hasn't navigated before. There's an appetite, and we've got a different philanthropic culture in our economy. You know, when Jared retires and all of that wealth gets put to purpose, it doesn't go to a library, and that might be the case in the United States. But his wisdom is available, and there's an awful lot of successful businessmen and women who I think have regretted retiring too early, that actually want to get out and get amongst and help the next generation of entrepreneurs. The third thing I'd talk about is there's no substitute for actually doing your homework. You know, I often see people frustrated that say a franchise hasn't worked out well for them because they've swallowed the advertising and thought they were buying an annuity. My advice is buy an annuity if that's what you want. The fourth thing would be the world's run by people who turn up. You know, have your voice heard. Something's not working for you, stalk your local member. Get involved in the Chamber of Commerce. Understand the rhythms and the opportunities that others have seen. The last piece is we've got to get to grips with technology. Every small business I've met, and me included, and I imagine most people in this room, have been stooged by a technology vendor. They've paid way too much for capability that hasn't materialised and hasn't transform their business because nothing changed in their business. They just digitised something. As a consequence, half of Australian small businesses are invisible on the internet. Invisible. Yet 4 out of 5 Australian consumers do at least an initial inquiry usually a mobile device. It doesn't need to be an elaborate thing, but if you're wanting to get your motor mower repaired in Double Bay, mower repaired Double Bay, and if you're invisible, you'll probably go somewhere else. Now, so actually that technological engagement is something that I really think we need to turn our mind to. And that's a message I have. And how do we do that? Not by me saying it. By showcasing pathfinders who can look at someone just like them and say, here's what I do. The microbrewery in Mornington exports to Singapore. You know, the Washington State cherry grower in the United States sold hundreds and hundreds of tons of fresh cherries into China. you know, a perishable good with a limited shelf life. What did they do? Alibaba and the Tmall platform acted as a dating service. That farmer, from the time the buds were coming out in the tree, there was a social media campaign like, my golly, look at those buds. These will be great cherries. That's how it started. And then right throughout the development of an authentic, fine, high-value, high-priced produce, the purchasers who part paid for it in China watched their cherries being grown, harvested, chilled, shipped, delivered. 500 million e-commerce consumers in China alone. Is there a better way of matching our high-value, high-return, premium quality, optimum food security offering than using that platform? If there is, I can't think of it.
We'll go there, and then we'll go to
Senator, former senator, sorry about that.
Minister, like you, I started a small business as a sideline. It was back in the 80s when the Hawke-Keating era, when interest rates were 17%.
Yeah.
We blundered around for a few years and eventually made a profit. But what really struck me at that time was the lack of availability of training for small business people. And if this is going to be an engine room for the Australian economy with so many people in small business, what are the policies of the government to better improve the training for people in small business so they can have a better...
Look, great question. And even intending small businesses.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's a success if someone's got a business idea and they, on reflection and on taking on board advice, think it's perhaps not for them or they need to further develop the idea. That's a win. That's a win. You're not consuming capital. You know in our economy, if a business gets a hay fever sniffle, there's a tendency of banks and the tax office to want to harvest the organs pretty quickly, and that's not a great way of carrying on a going concern. It's quite different from what you see in other jurisdictions. What we're doing is we run what's called an ASBAS program, the Australian Small Business Advisory Service. It's a competitive tender process. We're not-for-profits with skin in the game. That is, they've got other sources of revenue and other ways of demonstrating credibility in the eyes of small business people in their region. They offer a range of services, usually initially at no cost, and then as it scales up in specificity and complexity, then there may be a fee involved. It does a few things. Know your numbers, which is a nice way of saying financial literacy. You'd be surprised how many small businesses don't have the grasp of pretty fundamental cash flow issues. They also, with the demise in the GFC of second tier and non-bank low doc, no doc lenders, small businesses are needing to find the language of the banking system to be able to better present their proposition and understand what the back of house credit metrics are that a bank will run so they can meet that market. There's also an issue about business planning and strategy that, you know, with the disruptors in the economy, we're encouraging people to think about what's going on in their space. How will they delight the customers and where will they find them? You know, it's sort of like if you want to go duck hunting, go where the ducks are, you know, and working out what that looks like. Then there's a piece around technology engagement for reasons I just touched on. And the last one is actually around knowing your team. Succession planning is a real challenge at the moment, particularly in family businesses. The idea that it was like a royal family that the firstborn bloke would take over the business is downright dopey. And a lot of family businesses are realising that, and they're now investing in succession planning and actually thinking about new business models that might see someone brought in, that might trigger a need to restructure, which we've dealt with in the budget, that might involve an employee share scheme, and we've fixed the tax issues there at a price tag of $200 million. That's only the start of it. The other thing I'd say to you is this advice is everywhere. My challenge is to try and act as a concierge, because everyone's in this space. All the banks offer this kind of services. A lot of the industry associations do. A lot of the software vendors do. Your taxpayer dollars have even funded a online how to be an entrepreneur kit and tuition that the University of Western Sydney produced. So I'm trying to bring all of that to the table. In my own city in Frankston, we've put on 3 technology platforms. It didn't cost me a cent. Google wanted to do it, Facebook wanted to do it, PayPal and BPay wanted to do it. And to give you an idea, we had 120 places, and I think all those were taken in an hour and a half. So to try and bring that whole game to the table is part of it. The last thing I'd say is time-poor small businesses shouldn't need a PhD in constitutional feng shui. It's too hard. I mean, there's bits of government activity going everywhere at different levels of government. And so what I'm trying to do is funnel that into an easily discoverable place and also tapping the accountants. We're quite unique in our country. Accountants are trusted advisors well beyond their area of technical expertise in our economy. It's quite incredible. Most business people will think, oh, what should I do with my business strategy? I'll go and ask my accountant. You know, or you know, should I branch out and have a go at the cherry market in Korea now that the 20% tariff or whatever it is has come off. Now, most accountants are pretty good, but they need to be spectacular to understand that degree of sophistication. They are in a position, though, to have the eyeballs, if I could use that term, of the small businessmen and women. And maybe through that we can open up other channels that are there but are scattered all over the place and, frankly, too hard to find.
Question here. Minister, my question is regarding employment. Many of us, years ago, when we finished school or looking for our first job, our natural instinct, in my case, was placed to go to a bank or a major retailer or a major corporation or public service. And my understanding is these days the jobs of those traditional big firms or big organisations, largely due to their greater use of technology, meant that those job opportunities or entry points have vanished. And the point's been made that increasingly the young will have to look at focus on the small business sector and the importance that raises about how you do it, because it raises the skill of networking, particularly you might have.
That's a great question and a very astute observation. You're exactly right, and that's what we see as well. That in terms, I mean, let me give you some numbers. 40% of all our unemployed people are youth, and many of them are worried about when are they going to get their opportunity in the economy. Where's that toehold going to come from? Where's that chance to develop workplace know-how? How are they going to show a prospective employer that they can make a good value contribution in that workplace? Now, in many cases, in the majority of cases, that's in a small business. But if you saw, and those statistics are quite compelling about the contraction of small business employment under the previous government, that's why we're trying to change it. If you want to look at what's possible, look at the United States. Post-GFC, 64% of all new net private sector jobs were in a small business. Even the welfare lobby sees that the launching pad of a career for many people who are struggling getting into the workforce is a small business. Even for the self-employed, you know, I'm a real advocate for people finding a pathway that plays to their strengths. And for many, that's not university. So I'm a big fan of technical qualifications and vocational careers. But once we've trained an electrician, I want them to get business acumen as well. So they know how to price a job, know how to set up their business. And these are the things that we need to knit together. The other thing I'd point to is that for some of the costs of employment land disproportionately heavily on a small business. Some of the big businesses can do sweetheart EBAs that give them some relief of penalty rates, and that's difficult for a small business to do. The flexibility mechanisms in the industrial relations regime haven't been designed for a small business. You know, they've been designed by the club, the IR club, and these are the things that we need to change so that ecosystem encourages the small business to say, yes, I can grow. And imagine if only half put on one extra person. What a transformation in our employment scenario that would produce. So I'm with you on that. There's no single silver bullet, and that's why we're working on a number of fronts to make attractive to an enterprising person the formation of a business, and we've got record highs last financial year, and then to go to that next step, a little app that helps you, my first employee, you know, navigating that across state and territory and Commonwealth jurisdictions can be a nightmare. So that's the work that we're putting in to try and achieve exactly what you see.
Now, there are a lot of people here who've got their hands up, so we've got to be very quick. John.
Yes.
Hi, John.
Yeah. Yeah, just following on, same with the labour market, it seems to me that the government's gone quiet on reform, and there are opportunities, for example, in penalty rates, where we're seeing Sydney businesses not opening on the weekends, and the other one is the big issue of Sydney versus Burnie, for example, which Jared gave some time back about the difference in costs, and so it's going to be, why can't wages be cheaper in a place where it's, like the country, New South Wales, for example, where it's cheaper to employ somebody, but the same wages apply across the country.
Well, look, you're touching on a bit of a hot button for me. I mean, the idea of national consistency in workplace relations laws played very strongly into the hands of big businesses that operated across multiple jurisdictions. They thought it was fantastic. Now, for the unincorporated, which constitutionally is a industrial relations space owned by the states and territories, they lost that ability to adapt to different circumstances. And to quote Judith Sloan at a function at the South Australian Chamber of Commerce, perhaps not received well by the audience in South Australia, was that if I'm going to have to pay Sydney and Melbourne wage rates, why wouldn't I run my business in Sydney and Melbourne? And that was the point that you're alluding to. We don't have that capacity to differentiate. That is within the gift of the states and territories. They can always resume back their constitutional power to set that industrial relations framework for non-incorporated businesses. I think that was in a discussion paper that the former Campbell Newman government canvassed, but they didn't proceed with it. So your first point, if I can come to that now, the Parliament doesn't set penalty rates. We don't sit in Canberra and freeze in winter deciding what the calibrations and activation points are of penalty rates. The law basically says for, I think it's unsociable hours, there will be a penalty rate. The rate of the rate and the circumstances under which it's activated is determined by His Honour Justice Ian Ross at the Fair Work Commission. Now, there is machinery in the current law which the restaurant and caterers have used to go back to the commission and saying the rate of the penalty rate you are applying to unskilled and semi-skilled hospitality workers is impeding those businesses from opening. And if you can't open, no one gets a shift, and therefore the rate that would apply becomes rather academic. There, the commission agreed, dialed it back. The unions took it to court, cost them, I think, $1.6 million to make the case. Too hard, too complicated, but that machinery is there. Secondly, you can, through the modern award process, these are being examined. And thirdly, a lot of small businesses make an error in paying the penalty rate on the market rate for ordinary hours. So if you were the world's greatest barista and we were paying you, $24 an hour rather than $19.50 or whatever it is, they apply the penalty rate to the $24 an hour. It should be to the $19.50. And if they're paying over the award on ordinary hours, by a simple agreement you lodge with nobody, you can lay offset the penalty rate against the over award payment for the ordinary hours. That is too complicated. You go to the website, you can't make head nor tail out of it. You ask a question about Easter Sunday, is that a penalty rate for a public holiday or a Sunday? You put that in and you get every judgment since Harvester that has those words in it. And you're sitting there and go, I just want some actionable information so I know what's required of me. This is the area where we need some work. That's what the Productivity Commission's doing its work on, and I'm looking forward to seeing their report.
Okay, so we've got 10 minutes and we've got a lot of hands up. Okay. There, and then we go over here.
Ben, do you have a view on the role of Chambers of Commerce in regional areas?
Do you have a view on the role of Chambers of Commerce in regional areas?
Yes. I'm adding to the short answers. No, I travel every week around the country, and I normally do a test, who's a member and who's not. I pick up the idea that the world's run by people who turn up. If you're unhappy about the car parking situation, get a part of your Chamber of Commerce. If you want to learn what others are learning and benefit from the wise counsel that surrounds you, join the Chamber of Commerce. If you want to have some avenue of information, join the Chamber of Commerce. I think not being a member of a Chamber of Commerce is one of the greatest false economies a small business could make. My message is find a chamber you're happy with, get amongst it, ask questions, share knowledge, probe others that are in the room, make the most of that network that I think is really very valuable and should be a part of every small business's armoury about learning, development, strategies and market intelligence. Join a Chamber of Commerce.
Down there near the wall? Yep.
Minister Harper's report makes some pretty controversial recommendations.
I picked that up too, Angus. I read the papers. There was a bit of division on a couple of them.
A bit of division, not Section 46, but so the pharmacy sector.
Yeah.
About ownership, location. Yep. I think the sixth agreement is now looking at the location rules for the next few years. Is there a view, though, that the Woolies and Coles want to get in on that sector? It's ultimately encroaching on a small business
sector. So it's a question, for background, it's a question about the Harper report with effect to pharmacies.
Yep. Yeah, there's a couple of issues in there. Harper was saying if you're going to have policy settings that are inherently anti-competitive, know why and be satisfied that that anti-competitive policy setting is the only way of achieving that policy goal. In the area of pharmacy, the location rules have been with us since 1990. They've been a feature of all pharmacy agreements. The reason for that is the promise of the PBS, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, is that you, wherever you are in this continent, will get access to affordable medicines within 24 hours. Therefore, the distribution channel to achieve that becomes very significant. That's what the location rules are aimed to do. Otherwise, you'd end up with 15 pharmacies in Paddington all competing and then no one in the Pilbara. And so that's what the location rules are about. What we've sought to do is say, well, in some areas that's been gamed a little bit. We've seen pharmacies relocate just to block the run of another business that might be offering an integrated health service. Secondly, in some of those areas, those location rules mean there's only one landlord. And Angus, I know from the Shopping Centre Council, you'd be horrified that there was only one landlord and what could be done to the pharmacist in that circumstance. In other examples, we've seen pharmacies open the door to have a supermarket in their business, which seems a little bit odd when they don't want a supermarket having a pharmacy in their business. So my message to the Pharmacy Guild is, if it's all about community pharmacy, which is the first to know network in our primary healthcare system, it's a real value they add, make sure you don't let yourself down by nurturing business models that lose that very point of difference that separates a pharmacy from a regular retail outlet.
There's a question there.
Yeah, you mentioned about impediments to business before. And I said, are you doing to encourage the dropping of important taxes?
Yeah.
Payroll taxes.
It's a ripper payroll tax. It's the one incendiary issue that gets everyone aggro stuck in the craw. Most of the states and territories would say we'd love to get rid of payroll tax. And I'll share with you government speak. They say as long as someone buys it out, which is code for Commonwealth, you want to get rid of it, you give us the money to replace it. So the tax white paper is trying to tease out what is the tax structure we need for our future as a nation and as an economy, and are there settings or measures in there that are contrary to that? 10 taxes raise 90% of all the revenue raised across three levels of government. There's another 100 shrapnel taxes that raise the last 10%. Payroll tax is something that economists call elegant because it's hard to avoid, few respondents, able to generate a nice amount of revenue for each interaction with the respondents. They love it. But it also is a tax on jobs, and aren't we about trying to create jobs? So that's the conversation that's happening through the tax white paper. I think the Henry Tax Review looked at it, although that $22 million worth of research is in a locked box under cabinet and confidence rules. What I'm told, though, is that if you went for a broader-based transaction tax, you could raise the revenue needed, simplify the whole process, and then buy out these dodgy taxes that aren't helping our goals and national ambitions. But, you know, that's work that's before the tax white paper process. If you have a view, the world's run by people who turn up, put the view in. And what we've done to make sure smaller businesses can do that, you don't need a tome to go in. You can put an email in with four paragraphs saying, here's my field evidence, this is what I think should happen. Take up the opportunity, would be my encouragement.
Just a really quick question. I was going to ask, in the budget you said that this small business could restructure their...
Yep.
I think that's a real win.
Yep. I loved it. I thought it was very sexy, but you know, not many of us did. So.
I reckon a lot of businesses when it clicks will really... Because they're so set up the wrong way.
Yeah.
Are you just going to say that just don't owe tax if they change? Just like
Can you just explain that point? Because
If you restructure...
They set themselves up as a trust and there should be a company.
And when you restructure, they're under certain circumstances, it's a trigger capital gains tax event.
Now, hang on, can you background this?
Yep. So, all right, let's pick up. Jared and I go into business, sort of wisdom consulting, proprietary limited. We set ourselves up as a company. We go through that for a few years and we think maybe that's not the right way for us. the maintenance costs of reporting requirements, etc., etc., we decide we should really be a partnership. Now, to simply take our business with no other moving parts, no change, it's a going concern, but to change the structure to better suit our ambitions, we want to go from an incorporated business to a partnership. That is a capital gains tax trigger event. So what would happen? We'd have to say, well, what was our business worth when it started? Well, not much, you know, reckless member of parliament, wise, highly, you know, with high degree of perspicacity in the other partner, maybe a price to Jared, I might not be worth much. But at the time we go and restructure, our business is worth considerably more. And that spread is the capital gains tax liability. We're saying that's ridiculous. If all we're doing is making like with like, but getting a more appropriate structure. Not quite, but I'm simplifying for people who don't love this stuff as much as you and I do. we're trying to mitigate against that capital gains tax trigger event.
No, it's complicated enough as it is.
That's it.
One question, though.
Hang on.
A really, really good thing was when you reduced the asset fees when you set up a company.
Yep.
They should keep doing
that. Yeah, I want to go further. Those $236 for business name registration is a tax. That money, the cost to run the registry is about $17. So the rest of it is used to supervise the market. My view is supervision of the market should be paid for by the people who are being supervised, not a price gouge off small business. Anyway, that's work in progress. I haven't quite got there on that one, and I've probably already said way too much. So,
he's only asked three questions.
He's done well, but if you've got any thoughts on the other thing, let me know.
Yeah, don't ask him now.
He did well.
He did very well.
Is he related to him?
No, he's not.
Okay.
Not yet. Down the back. Have you got a question?
I think Angus and I have answered it, Minister, but you mentioned the United States. What I put to you is that a completely deregulated lending system, as such exists in North America, has given practically all retail back to the oligopolies.
Yeah.
There are no independent chemists, no independent butcher shops, no independent fish shops, no independent fruit and veg. They do not exist.
Yeah.
Right? 99% of the time.
Yeah.
Here in Australia, we've got more of a planned system that actually protects independence.
Yeah.
Doesn't that fly in the face of the Harper recommendations?
Yeah.
So do you want to reflect on the United States situation?
Well, I mean,
it is a final comment. Okay.
Your observation's good. I mean, the Heritage Foundation in Washington, though, when I met them about land use planning, because I think we can do a better job of this, they said to me, Bruce, look at the great cities of the world. Town planners weren't even invented at the time. And I thought, okay, well, maybe that's one argument. But in a contemporary sense, I think your observation's right. What Harper was saying was don't deregulate it completely. Harper was saying have more flexible and strategically focused land use planning rules, have certainty so that if you front up and you're investing in a development that's consistent with those rules, there needs to be a really good reason why you can't proceed with it. It was also saying in the contest and the appeals process, impact on competitors shouldn't be a land use planning consideration. So that, he was basically saying, the panel was basically saying, at the moment there's so much stacked against actually getting something done that that needs to be revisited. Your point is very relevant here. One of the key advocates for greater land use planning flexibility is ALDI. I hope I'm not misquoting them, but I recall in a discussion I had with them, they would have rolled out twice the number of outlets added to competition had the land use planning framework been more supportive. And the other thing is, when it's made more flexible, that doesn't stop other parties making use of that circumstance. The only area where it's worked in practice along lines of the theory is in Canberra. And that's because the land use planning regulator also happens to be the landlord. And as the owner of the property and the regulator, they could release land into the marketplace and then say, you can't play in this market, will support these players, and that's a more interventionist approach. So the ideas that Harper has identified, operationalising them, brings a whole another field of joy, and you've touched on some of those considerations.
Okay, many thanks.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
As you can see, the Minister is a very energetic politician, and no doubt that explains to some extent why he's been so successful. Well, it appears he's been so successful within the Cabinet in the lead up to this budget. So it's great to have Bruce Bilson along tonight up from Melbourne, and no doubt we'll have him back in the future. But for tonight, congratulations and well done.
Thank you.
you have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.